Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Old Brother, a podcast about Salford slash Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. I'm sure you know you can find us at Spotify and Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. You can also get all episodes on YouTube. You can search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss one. This week we're joined by TV presenter, DJ, author and my St. Bede's alumnus, Terry Christian, who joins us to discuss his memories of watching and working with the group. Apparently I had some issues with my gear, but I rarely say anything of note, so it shouldn't spoil their enjoyment too much. Hello, welcome to the latest episode of Old Brother, a podcast about The Fall with me, Paul Hanley, and my esteemed brother, Stephen. Say hello, Steve.
Hello.
Is that it?
You said say hello.
Hello! Anyway, our guest today, we're delighted. Rubbish. Our guest today is the esteemed Manchester journalist, TV presenter and DJ, Mr. Terry Christian. Good afternoon, Terry, how are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, I'm good.
Hello, are you all right?
Mired in the past, 61. You'd believe that about me, eh?
I can't believe it. Looking at you, I can't believe you're 61.
Never had to work for a living.
You're not dying your hair. It's not Johnny Marr Black, is it?
It was, and then I just decided, you know, give that one a rest. It wasn't fooling anybody.
What are you trying to say about Johnny Marr, Paul?
No, nothing. No, no. Well, I mean, I think he's probably turned grey overnight after Morrissey's latest letter.
Yeah,
I think.
Morrissey having a go at him, yeah.
Did you see that?
No, but I mean, again, if it was my hair, it would have turned grey by listening to all my own solo albums.
I did like
Down on the Corner, though, off the Johnny Marr and the Healers album. I just find, you know, his stuff's all right. I wouldn't get overexcited about it.
Yeah.
Well, I'd rather Johnny Marr stuff than Morrissey stuff.
Though. It's good live.
I quite like Morrissey's stuff. I mean, they should re-record some of them old Smiths ones, though, shouldn't they? You know, like one where that goes, I would go out tonight if I could find a black shirt to wear.
If I could find a shirt that fits, I think he'd be singing these days, wouldn't he? Well, anyway, welcome to the latest episode of the Smiths podcast with me and Steve.
I could talk about them all day as well.
Yes, indeed. Well, much as I'd enjoy that, I think we're going to have to bring up the subject of The Fall. So we were talking last week, and I believe that you first saw The Fall supporting Magazine in October 1977 at Rafters, is that right?
Yeah, Rafters. And in fact, it was around the same time we went through a flurry of gigs, went to see Steel Pulse. That might have been maybe a month later at Manchester Poly. That was only a quid. They always, I mean, Rafters is a weird place because most bands, it was like a quid 20, then Elvis Costello, a quid 50. Remember going to see Dillinger there, £1.75. But we obviously, we wanted to see Magazine because of the Buzzcocks connection. Yeah. And the four, really, we wouldn't have taken any notice of who the support band was, except for the fact that a mate of mine, Terry Ryan, his younger sister, Teresa, was at Notre Dame, you know, the old girls' Catholic Catholic grammar school in Cheetham Hill. And yeah. She was best mates with Maureen Baines. His big sister was Una Baines, who was in the four. So, again, it was that kind of idea of, you know, because I'd known John Marr out of Buzzcocks. It was that idea of, oh, we can now touch people who are sort of famous. I mean, it was a different thing. People can't imagine what Manchester was like before that era. You know, how we were kind of a bit nothing in a way.
Yeah. Mm. It's definitely. Well, I was going to say, did you never get to the Electric Circus then, Teddy? Because the first time Steve saw the Fall was like earlier the same month at the last night of the Electric Circus.
No, not at all. I mean, you've got to remember, you know, we had no money. I lived in the Manchester 16 postcode. You had no chance of getting a Saturday job. The minute they saw M16, they just thought you were a thief. And it's true. You know, we used to have the highest insurance rates, you know, in like sort of Manchester because of that postcode back in the day, you know. Right. I never really had any money, you know. So, you know, people who went out had money. You know, I can remember, you know, the first forays that we made, you know, to places like Rafters. You know, the great thing about punk for us was you could drink underage. And also it was like, it was fairly cheap. So you'd get him for like a quid 20, a quid, go and see some rubbish, you know, like the Radio Stars. We used to love going to see Deaf School, actually. They were our favourite band, you know, from Liverpool at the time. Yeah. And then beer prices were cheap. And then a taxi, if five of us got a taxi from town, it was like cheaper than the bus fare in. It was like 20p each.
Get you?
Well, we live so near, you know. I mean, I was about a mile from the city centre.
Sorry, Steve.
Had you been going to gigs before that, like at the Free Trade Hall and the Opera House and the
Palace? No, not at all, because, again, it was down to affordability. So, I mean, my first gigs were those punk gigs, and it was going to see Freebies, you know, like, you know, bands like Gags playing at the Midland, oh, no, the Cavalcade, that was it, in Didsbury and stuff like that. So, there were kids who did go to those sort of gigs and would go and see, like, Roxy Music and see this band and see that band. But I just never had the money like they did.
Where did you get your money? Oh, you had a job, didn't you, Steve?
Pardon?
You had a job.
I had a job. I was just going to say, I was worked at a hotel in Sale, and Gags had a residency there.
Yeah, but you're older than me again, aren't you?
A bit older than you, yeah. A couple of
years. Yeah. So you would have had money. I mean, it was just one of those weird things, you know. In the sixth form at Beeds, the only money I had was from working, and it was a good job at Esso in Trafford Park over the summer, and that was brilliant because, you know, it's Transport and General Workers Union rates. Even got £1 a day luncheon vouchers.
Blimey. And it did help that
my dad was a shop steward as well.
Right. So was he a big union guy then, your dad?
Eh?
Was he a big union guy, your dad, I presume?
Yeah, well, I mean, on a very pragmatic level. So the thing that he did at Esso in Trafford Park, you know, because he'd just be like what they call a plant operator, you know, labourer. So, you know, they used to roll barrels off the ships before they had the direct pipeline to Milford Haven because it was on the docks.
Yeah.
And then they'd have to fill, they'd have like plants where they'd be filling like antifreeze gear oil when they used to have that automatic transmission fluid, you know, and all these different lines, and then, you know, drive a forklift truck and, you know, pack things by, you know, stack things by hand as well.
Yeah.
But what they used to do, because they were so busy, all the blokes would have to work one in three Saturdays. And what my dad did was he went to the bosses there, he said, yes, we'll work the one in three Saturdays, but instead of an hour for lunch, we'll have 45 minutes and then we'll still do the one in three Saturdays to make, you know, because we won't need to make up our hours, but that will be time and a half. Now, that was real socialism, wasn't it?
Of course it was, yeah. I mean, you know, similar to my dad worked at Dunlop's in, you know, on Upper Cambridge Street, so not far from you, really. So that's, he was a charge hand there, so probably very similar experience, I would have thought. He, you know, that kind of, like you say, that pragmatic kind of socialism.
Yeah, and that's what's been lost, you know, whereas when our Kevin, he was the year above you, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah.
at St. Bede's, when our Kev was like the union rep at A-Town Street, you know, when he was working in the Dole office there, when they wanted to sort out temp workers, they got some bloke floated in from the local trade union. He said, right, before we have the meeting, can we all agree that we fully support the Sandinistas in Nicaragua?
Yeah, he talks about that. Mark Steele, when he first like joined the Socialist Workers Party, you know, you'd have the first 2 hours of the meeting would be saying, "Can we, you know, what's the feminist angle on the wages? You know, the on the papers." So they never actually got anything done. It was all sort of that. So were you still at St. Bede's when you were on that Devil's Advocate? Were you
no? I left then. That was quite a while later. So I was like 2021 when he was on that.
Right. Okay. Because we were just mentioning Johnny Marr, he was on that as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he was 17. We used to chat to him because he had like the Echo and the Bunnyman haircut going on, you know.
He did. He was like the big man on campus at Withenshaw College where I was, Johnny Marr.
Well, he got really upset when he moaned on it. He said the only thing he didn't like about being on the Dole was like the low Dole money, but he actually liked being on the Dole because he could practice his guitar all day. And Gus McDonald was disgusted with him and told him off. And he was nearly crying, Johnny, after that.
Well, he was right though, wasn't he?
Well, but you know, I was quite surprised that, you know, I thought, well, you know, that's just part of the ding dong. That's what it is. You know, you get stick, then you've got to come back at it.
Yeah, well, not everyone's as good at that as you, Terry.
No, it wasn't so much that. It was just like you can't stick your big bottom lip out, you know, and that's what surprised me. Lads from Withenshaw went down in my estimation after seeing him do that.
Excuse me.
Watch it. Right, so that was in case anybody didn't know, that Devil's Advocate, it was like it was a bit like Question Time, sort of, wasn't it? But for young people.
Well, but the weird thing was, it was made by the World in Action team, and it was networked at 20 to 7 on a Sunday night. So everybody saw it, because the only other things that were on the telly at the time, three channels, were the Money Programme and Songs of Praise.
Yeah.
So I got more fans. Well, I think a bit later on, but it was kind of, you know, it was in a time slot where everybody watched it.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because it was quite uncut, and it was all based on the findings of the Scarman report after the riots of 1981. And the reason they chose Manchester was that Thatcher's reform, well, Thatcher's, you know, policies of lifting tariffs on textile imports and manufacturing goods had destroyed our industry in Manchester. So Manchester went from a place of quite high employment for young people to virtually no employment for anyone between the ages of 16 and 21.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was just talking about stuff like, you know, the riots, and it was, you know, the high levels of youth unemployment, the sus laws, which are kind of coming back again, you know, nuclear weapons, blah, 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 all sorts of stuff, you know. And then you know, fascinating for people to watch, because someone would tune in and see some lad from Hardwick going, the trouble with when you go to school here is you don't learn you nothing. that is great Sunday evening viewing. And then because as you know, me being ex-St. Bede's and very well read and articulate.
As we all are.
I was accused of being a Trotskyist plant.
Blimey. Well, I mean, that whole thing, I mean, you could get into that whole thing of, like, working class intelligence, because that's something that ties into the Fall and Mark, I think. That idea that...
Oh, very well done, there, Paul.
Thank you very much. You can be firmly working class, but still highly intelligent, and not that, you know. And it seems to be now that it's harder. People don't believe it anymore. I don't know why. I think
the last people that anyone's able to pick on are the working classes. I mean, I've basically had it for 40 years working in the media, you know, because it's kind of, you're lauded and then you're never judged on your CV. So, no. it kind of gets you down a bit. What was fascinating about Marquis Smith for me when I met him, because, I mean, the Fall, you've got to remember, there are loads of other bands around that I kind of preferred because I liked to tune back in the day, and I was never a fan of stuff like...
What are you saying?
I was never a fan of stuff like Captain Beefheart, but then... I remember I loved, like, Totally Wired, so I bought that. Then I bought How I Wrote the Elastic Man. And then when I went to Derby, I remember thinking, oh, I can afford it now. So I bought Live Dream of a Casino Soul. you know, right. which had come out fairly recently. But then I remember one of the first times I interviewed Mark, and I was chatting to him about the song "Lie Dream of a Casino Soul." And I said, the guy who did the Northern Soul slot on my show on BBC Radio Derby, Dave Evison, you know, it was like the Wigan ex-Wigan Casino, the oldies DJ there.
Yeah.
When I said to him, oh, have you heard this? He said, heard it. He said, I bought three copies of it in case it becomes worth something one day.
he never actually listened to it.
No, that with actually,
he's still got them.
That actually tickled Mark. I mean, ironically, that's probably true, but it's worth about 30 quid now, isn't it?
Tell me about it. Some of them records, there was one came up the other day and it was like...
Yeah, ridiculous, wasn't it?
Yeah. Because I've got nothing. Have you, Steve?
It's £150 or something. It was going.
Oh, which one was that?
It was.
I can't remember what it was now.
This Nation's Saving Grace. First pressing or something.
Oh my God! You see, I mean, the weird thing is because once I started working on BBC Radio Derby from '82, and then I interviewed.
For nothing.
But I got everything of yours for now. From then on, you know, up until the mid '90s. So it was probably the late 90s, and even then I'd still get Chuck stuff, you know, like, you are missing winner. And, I mean, they seem to avalanche out about two a year, or it seemed to me later on down the line. Yeah. But so I would have said that the fullest catalogue of any band other than maybe Curtis Mayfield that I had, but I never had his singles, was The Fall.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, coincidentally, almost. And in some ways, it's only maybe been the last 10 years or so that I've started to go, oh, yeah, they're really good, aren't they? I mean, you know, I always liked you, but I found it, some of the live experiences hard work. Like, I mean, it was a great gig at the Blue Note Club on the Hex Induction Tour. So that was the first night, you know, Mark Smith came in on our radio show, puked up in a waste paper basket because he said he'd eaten some rotten bacon, and then was on for like 30 minutes. And we even played the classical. Well, you could play what you wanted on the radio in those days. And then me and this girl who helped out on the show, Ros Vexey, we went over to the Blessington, which is a pub across the road, very nice, director's pub, real ale, and settled in there with Mark till about 10 o'clock because he didn't need to do sound checks. That's what you lads did.
Well, he might grace us with 5 minutes, you know, shouting at the sound man, but it wasn't an extensive experience sound checking with Mark normally.
Yeah, well, he did say that, but you know, when he's had a few drinks and he was there chatting about, you know, it's like, you know, I'd die for the lads. I'd die for those lads, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You go, yeah, great. You know?
He nearly did a couple of times.
I'd do anything for the lads. I'd die for them. You know what I mean?
Well, that was, that ex-induction hour tour was probably the closest that lineup were. It kind of tapered off towards the end of that year, but when we did ex-induction hour, we were pretty tight then, weren't we, Steve?
Yeah.
Oh, everybody loved that gig. And again, I was like, wow. Because, I mean, I'd seen you before and you were really good at Tiffany's when it was you, the Distractions, and the things were billed. So either we arrived too late and missed them. Because, again, they were a Liverpool band, weren't they? But John Marr, who I'd gone to school with, you know, primary and secondary school, he was supposed to be playing with them. And I don't know if they even played that night. You know, obviously, that was a great night, though, and a great gig.
Are you sure that wasn't the Things that John Marr was playing with?
Yeah. No, he was supposed to be, yeah, but I don't know if they turned up on the night because when we arrived, it was the Distractions, then you.
Where was Tiffany's?
It was at Tiffany's in town, so above Rafters. But it was bigger, or was it Fagan's? It was one of them.
Yes, Fagan's, yeah.
I remember you were virtually all just spread out on the floor in front of us. There didn't seem to be much of a stage there.
Well, that gig, that gig we played with the Distractions, that was the first two drummer gig, that. That was the first time we did it. So we didn't really know what the hell we were doing.
But I think that was all the time of Grotesque, because, you know, with...
Just slightly later than that, but yeah, that was that Frank... Fagan's gig was the first two drummer gig, and then that over that next year we did X Induction Hour.
Yeah, that's right, because it was '81. But I did think, wow, they're a really good band. They're really good now.
Yeah, I think we were better live. I think we were better live then than some of the records.
It's hard to say, you know, because obviously, you know, I mean, I remember I did have Grotesque on a cassette. You know, someone had taped it for me.
Yeah.
We had that, you know. So, again, you know, a lot of stuff you'd catch up with later, because the amount of products you put out, you know, until I was, like, working at Radio Derby and, you know, and earning money. And then obviously I got a lot of records for free, you know, and I was an expert tracking down all the stuff that I wanted. So all the labels that you happen to be with, I had good relationships with, you know, with like people like Terry Hollingsworth at Beggars, you know, the guys at Rough Trade, you know, Brenda Kelly when she ran the sort of the Independent Label Association, you know, and I used to get, you know, sorted out for like, you know, reggae labels like the Fashion Label in London and Green Sleeves and all that, you know, so I was a real hustler. I was a real kind of scrounger like that.
Yeah. So how long were you at Lady O'Darby then?
6.5 years. So, but I mean, it was good for me because it was kind of almost all my ambitions were fulfilled anyway, because I had my own radio show that was very groundbreaking. It had won 2 National Sony Radio Awards, you know, for the best specialist music show. I got into all the gigs free within that massive area, put gigs on myself, including you lot at Tiffany's in Derby on Babington Lane. That was July 83.
They weren't all called Tiffany's. That's 2 Tiffany's.
Maybe I'm getting Fagan's and Tiffany's mixed up, but it was definitely Tiffany's in Derby because it was quite a big space. And we put you on there and put this local band, who were a bit like a third-rate version of the birthday party called Canker Opera, on supporting you. And it was the first time I'd ever met Brix, because she wasn't in the band, but she was hanging around with Mark backstage. And Mark had gone from being really friendly to me towards me to being a little bit cutting, because he thought that I hadn't sorted the BBC out to pay you enough, and your rider wasn't great, and you'd been put up in the Friary Hotel, which was okay, but it was, you know, it was all of this kind of stuff. And then he punched the lead singer, Nick Jackson, in the face. Because apparently he was being accused of stealing his cigarettes. And what was great was, as I walked in to say hello to Mark, Nick Jackson was walking past me going, "Don't talk to me about the effing industrial estate. You are the industrial estate," which is a bit crazy, but sounded funny.
Not the best insult, I suppose.
No, but with Derby, that was quite good. It's not a natural thing with the locals there, you know, that kind of repartee. So that wasn't bad, really.
Hey, well, that was, well, it kind of got up to be a bit like Mark Occasionally, but he wasn't normally.
No.
I don't remember it in anybody. Do you, Steve?
No.
Not then.
No, it was just him. So it was like, it was backstage. I just remember that he was moaning a bit about the rider. Then the fags had been stolen, and I think he'd run out of fags or something. So that was it. That was the first glimmer I got of that side of him. I mean, but it was all right. I wasn't bothered. You know, it wasn't me, was it?
No. So he went a bit off with you then, but you got on with him very well over the years, though, didn't you, I think?
Well, the weird thing is, because I really admired him, because the one thing I never had was that level of massive confidence. I always needed, you know, I'm the fourth of 6 kids. I always needed a certain amount of validation. Oh, that was funny, Terry. Oh, that was good. Blah, blah, blah. Whereas like Mark didn't need that validation. Nobody, he didn't need anyone to tell him he was great, did he? Sort of just felt like he was, which is very unusual for anybody who's working class. I mean, obviously it could be bordering on narcissism. Yeah. I mean, Tony Wilson was like that as well. But, you know, Tony Wilson was a different form of thinking he was great to Mark's. I mean, what I did like about Mark, though, was that he was very observant about stuff, and he could often see it seemed to me at that age, he could see through all the bull to what was at the centre of it. But we used to argue about politics, we used to chat about stuff, have a laugh about stuff. He used to really take the mickey out of me all the time, you know, when I'd interview him about the fact that I'd had 2 pints, I could never remember the names of your weird songs, you know. the hotel Boudel, and he'd be going, "Oh God, again." You know what I mean? He liked that opportunity to be able to take the piss, and the fact that I would find it funny anyway. But our normal kind of semi pub crawl, because what I'd do is every time you release a new album. So the first time we did it was Room to Live, and I rang up. Kay Carroll set it up, and so I met him with a tape recorder, you know, they're really heavy, which was like BBC standard issue, in Tommy Duck's in Manchester. Saturday lunchtime, midday, chucked a few down in there, you know, Green or Whitley's bitter. Yeah, then we went to the Britain's Protection, and had a few in there. Then at 3 o'clock, when they booted us out, we went to Effie's, that Turkish place in St. Peter's Square.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had like kebab and chips. And then we went and ended up, for some weird reason, I think I was getting it. No, I was staying at my mum's that night. Ended up in the beer cellar on the approach road. At 5 o'clock or whenever they opened up again.
That was a rough house, that was.
Well, I mean, you never thought of that. I mean, it's hard to think of places being a rough house when you're from, when you're from like Brooks Bar, like me.
Yeah.
And I mean, the living shore's not that soft. How can you go around thinking that's a rough house?
No, but even then,
did you actually get an interview in between all that?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And I used to feel about. I'm so gutted I haven't got them because I do some fantastic stuff. And I used to get outtakes because we just put it out there. I remember once asking him about, there was stuff in the press saying that Robert Smith out of The Cure didn't like him, and, you know, Morrissey had just come out and said he didn't like him. And I was saying, well, what do you think of that? He said, well, you know, as far as Robert Smith's concerned, he said, this is probably just something, you know, that he's heard about him. He said, but I don't like him anyway. And then he said, as for Morrissey, He goes, again, this is just something he's heard from people around him, that I don't like him, so he doesn't like me. You know, but I've never said any such thing. And I said to him, so well, what do you think of Morrissey then? He said, as far as I'm concerned, he's just a fucking paranoid.
Nice.
He's just a boy George with short hair.
We'll beep that, Teddy.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make any difference. That went out on BBC Radio Derby back in 1982.
Wow. Well, I mean, if you could play the classical, I'm sure that, you know, the word.
Nobody cared in those days. When you were doing a programme that was on the fringes, the first couple of records would put off anyone who would complain, and then you were just allowed to get on with it, you know. So, you know, and our producers didn't care either, you know. So we'd play every song we played, had effing and jeffing and all sorts in. It was a proper show, mate, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is that thing. Sorry, Steve.
I was going to say, you're back on there now, are you?
Well, I just did 5 shows for the 40th anniversary. So I did actually play, I think I played Kick a Conspiracy by the 4. But, I mean, we played loads of 4 on that show because we were on, you know, 5 nights a week. Then it went to 4 nights a week, but a longer show. So, you know, the 4, all those Manchester bands were our staples, really.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, because obviously, even in a place like Derby, it's something that's cool and not from London. So there was always a lot of Liverpool bands around, a lot of Manchester bands, you know, in the 80s that were of interest. And then we play, like, you know, jazz funk imports, you know, reggae prees. We play all sorts.
Yeah. So, because that was a kind of a crossover thing that I don't think that many people do. I mean, I know Peel did it a bit, but playing black music and white music alongside each other, I don't think you get it quite so much now, do you?
Well, I mean, the kind of stuff that we played, you know, you've got to remember, I brought in other specialists. So I had a Norman Soul slot. I had a guy, Devin Daly, who did our jazz funk, and we'd play all the new, you know, black music that was coming out at the time, whether it was electro, hip-hop, house, garage. So we had all of that, and it was almost like me going to university. So I learned off these people, and I always had a very eclectic taste in music anyway. I mean, to me, I don't do genres, you know. As far as I'm concerned, there's only 2 genres, good and bad. And I'm not interested in anything watered down or messed about with, you know. I hate it when they go, well, it's a kind of like, you know, Afro Celt jazz fusion. I go, well, I'm going to hate it.
I like a bit of Afro Celt jazz fusion. It's not the second.
I like a bit of Afro. I like a tiny bit of jazz. Not into the fusion bit.
No.
You know what I mean? And I'm into the Celtic stuff, but I'm not into the fusion. I like it as it is. You know what I mean? So, and on the funk side, you know, I was always like a bit, you know, I love going out. We used to go to places like Rotters, went to Legends in the old days, you know, in Manchester, when Friday, Saturday night, it'd be all like great music, you know, all the kind of jazz funk stuff that they play at Wigan Pier, you know. It's like early Cameo, Maze. Yeah. Slave.
I never made that cross the road from Rafters to Rotters, I must admit.
As a bass player, you know, Steve would have loved all that stuff like Pleasure, Glide by Pleasure, Aura, Slave. I mean, the bass lines in those songs were the best.
Right. We'll take your word for that, Terry.
Send them, yeah. I'll send you links. Get educated. It's never too late.
Never too late to educate, yeah. No. Okay.
You'll be able to draw in a certain ratio.
We're talking about a certain ratio with somebody. We're talking about the Manchester music scene being a bit sort of, everyone was a bit standoffish with each other. I mean, apart from Buzzcocks, who sort of helped everybody, nobody else seemed to like each other that much. Like, you know, New Order and Certain Ratio and The Fall, everyone kind of kept each other at arm's length a bit, which was difficult to do because we all use the same PA company.
And you'd all end up drinking in the same places,
yeah. And the thing is, Certain Ratio are the nicest bunch of people in the world when you meet them years later.
Yeah, well, they were weird. I remember when I first moved to Derby, New Order played in the February, but obviously you knew that they weren't going to do interviews, but I didn't know you had to set interviews up. So when A Certain Ratio played, I just went toddling down there with a tape recorder. And then after they came off stage and went backstage, said, "Hi, I'm Terry from the BBC. I'm here to do an interview." And they were going, you know, so they talked to me for ages, but they talked to me for ages about why they didn't do interviews, you know, the philosophy behind it all, which didn't sound very convincing to me, you know, and I was arguing, saying, well, that just sounds like rubbish, you know. I'm from a council estate in, like, Brooks Bar. I've only been at the BBC about 2 months. I'm not exactly, you know, Steve Wright in the afternoon. I'm not even sure if he was on it. I'm not anyone famous. I said, I'm down here because I'm a fan and I play your stuff, and you won't give me an interview. Why not? And then eventually they got down to this thing and said, look, you know, we're just for the people. And I went, so if you're for the people, how come you're playing in the most exclusive club in Derby, the Blue Note, and charging £3.50 a ticket?
£3.50 in them days? That's a lot of money,
to
that.
To get in. And this club, the Blue Note, was 90p a pint in those days, which was more expensive than anywhere in Manchester. Anyway, and then some bloke who I've seen sort of tour managing New Order and all those over the years, you know, his face, he just looked at me and said, listen, they told you they're not doing a fucking interview, so now fuck off. But in a really threatening manner.
Right.
So I did. And then the next day, furious about my undermining of my BBC status, I rang up the factory offices. And this bloke's on the line and he's saying, okay. He said, right. He said, well, look, he said, listen, and I told him the story, you know, and all my outrage about, you know, I'm the man of the people, not them playing for £3.50 in an exclusive club. And he went, listen, he said, I know who you are. And I was like, oh, you know, a bit taken aback. I said, yeah. And he said, and I know what your problem is. And I said, well, what's that? He said, you've got too much to fucking say. And he'd been in my big brother's class at St. Bede's.
Right. Okay.
Back in the day. I didn't know
Rob went to Bede's as well, did he?
Yeah, but he left in the fifth year. So he was one of the Withinshaw mob. So our Tony's best mates were these two brothers, the Hennessys, who used to play in like a Cayley band, and they were from Withinshaw.
Right.
And then another lad called Mike Doyle or Steve Doyle, who was from Withinshaw as well. So they used to all come on a special bus from Withinshaw to Beeds every day. But anyway, so after that, I actually got put on the mailing list for all the factory record stuff.
Right.
And Alan Erasmus even drove down to Derby twice to hand-deliver stuff to me.
Blimey. Well,
covers, rubbish records, you know.
I think New Order were slightly badly burned by interviews, weren't they? I don't think they were very good at it when they started. So I think they got kind of set up.
They weren't doing them at all in that era. The first time I did an interview with them was I interviewed Barney for Technique, and he was sound. Yeah, he was all right.
But George Wilson didn't do interviews, did they?
I mean, it's before my time, and again with Joy Division, I wasn't like a massive fan. In fact, I've still got the cassette where I recorded Unknown Pleasures that I borrowed off a mate of mine, and on the other side was like reggae hits, but it's all like, you know, the old ska ones like Young, Gifted, and Black. So there you go. I've got two albums all fitted on one nice Memorex
C90.
Yeah.
So, to be fair, you know, from listening to that, then I got into Joy Division a bit, but I was never like that massive fan of theirs. I mean, you know, I liked them and I liked those individual tracks, but, you know, I remember I saw them supporting the Buzzcocks at the Apollo, and again, I thought they were a bit like, they reminded me of like the sort of bands that punk was all about getting rid of.
Really? That was Joy Division, wasn't it? Supporting Buzzcocks at the Apollo.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, because the songs went on a bit too long, and it was like, Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, and it didn't sound like that record, did it? It was all like a bit heavy metal-ish.
I was going to say that. Yeah, they weren't...
All that drumming and what have you.
Like they were on record live. They were...
No. I mean, they were quite powerful, but it was like, this is a bit uncomfortable. This might be like watching, you know, one of those rock bands that we're not supposed to like anymore. It was a very strange era to grow up in, especially when you were like teenage. I remember like everyone moaning about the Stranglers saying, oh, God, and he's 27. You know what I mean? anybody over the age of, only anyone over the age of 21, you know, should have been, you know, been euthanized.
Well, you see, I've got this theory.
That's funny because it was like that when you were in a band. I always thought, I'm going to have to give this up by the time I'm 30. I can't be in a band when I'm 30. That's way too old.
Yeah, I mean, well, the weird thing was, it was anyone was old if they happened to be white, unless we're Lou Reed.
Yeah.
But it was okay to be a black guy and be in your 30s, you know what I mean? Little Bobby Bland or whatever, James Brown.
Yeah,
you know, well, in his 40s probably at that time. But, you know, so it was kind of weird like that. But, yeah, it did redefine this idea of what is and isn't cool. Yeah. And that became really important for about 5 years. And looking back on it, you think, oh, God, it's so geeky.
Yeah, well, I've got this theory that people of Steve's age and slightly older pretended that they didn't like stuff pre-1976, that it was all crap. Whereas people who are of my age, who are slightly younger, believed that shite and ended up, you know, just listening to, you know, New Wave. Whereas they were saying, oh, no, it's all shit that went before. But they all said, I'll add, you know, Billion Dollar Babies and all the Bowie albums and Roxy Music and everything else stashed behind the latest Jam album.
Well, to be fair, Alice Cooper, was all right. I tried to learn the harmonica bit of Generation Landslide, and then what is it? And then obviously, you know, that other stuff wasn't it. The stuff that was uncool at the time was Pink Floyd. You know what I mean? Not Genesis. Sid Barrett stuff. Genesis, yes. You know, Fleetwood Mac when Rumours came out. You know how harshly people were judged. Meatloaf, God rest his soul. You know, if you were 18 or 19 and into Meatloaf, you were given a wide berth when I was at college. Hotel California by the Eagles, you were going, okay, you know, we quite like Take It to the Limit, still a great song, but come on, Johnny Come Lately and all that stuff. Get a life, mate. And it was always kids from the burbs. And as for when Supertramp Breakfast in America came out, I mean, I know it's not a 10-year offence, but I felt like it should have been. So, yeah, there was prejudice against, Genesis. Seconds out with Follow You, Follow Me. Oh, my God.
I mean, it's a brilliant song. I mean, I don't care. Follow You, Follow Me is a fantastic song.
Okay.
It is.
Right. Yeah. Unless you had to hear it. You've got to remember, though, you know, all those songs on the Fleetwood Mac album, Rumours, were fantastic songs. Yeah. But it was like played to death. You were hearing it every time you switched the radio on in those days. Your ears were kind of bleeding from it.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, sometimes you can literally get too much of a good thing. And the Police were the same. And then I started to hate Blondie because I started DJing 78, 79 at Poly. And so when I was just doing the music in what was the cellar bar at this teacher training college where I was staying, if anyone came up and asked me for the Police or Blondie, I'd give them a Mark E. Smith style reply.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, and it's kind of similar to what you're saying, just how important music was to people. It was your whole life in a lot of ways. It defined everything about you.
Well, of course, it's almost like it was your touching with culture, because you've got to remember that it's from music and the music you like. So someone like Mark, then he'd talk about books and he'd talk about this. So then you go, I might have a read of that. Oh, I'll have a listen to them. I remember him asking him, you know, what stuff he was listening to at the time. And he put me on to Felt.
Right.
And all that stuff on the Zigzag label.
Yeah.
You know, and so he was always interesting like that, or he'd be talking about, you know, certain books that he'd read or he was reading at the time, and you know what I mean, and it made you think, yeah, well, I'll be cool, and I'll carry, and I was always a big reader anyway, so you know, you kind of hit on that level. I think everyone really in that era was a reader, because you know, there were three channels and there was nothing on the telly at night, you know what I mean, once you know it finished early. So you'd always be reading something. It wouldn't necessarily be great or, you know, high-powered stuff, but it'd be, you know, even you know, all those sort of conspiracy theories. So all the anti-vaxxers. Imagine if you bought out Chariot of the Gods now. They've all got their equivalent, haven't they? Yeah. You know, people.
God, everyone had that, didn't it? Was God an astronaut?
Yeah. Seven million copies or something mad like that.
And it's sold. It's a portfolio in that book, and it says, "Was this a landing runway for alien craft?" And there's a photograph.
Yeah, Nazca plane or whatever.
It's 3 foot across that picture.
Yeah. Well, I remember it just across from us from Old Trafford Library on Stretford Road. Somebody had put the graffiti there. If God was an astronaut, what does that make Neil Armstrong?
Hey. That's a bit deep for me.
Very,
that.
Very, very deep for Old Trafford, I'm telling you. in our local pub, in the pub quiz, they'd hold up an orange and say, "What colour is that?"
But you know the colour's named after the fruit. Did you know that? It is. So if you look at Robin Redbreast's, yeah, they're orange, but they didn't have the word orange. The colour orange is named after the fruit, not the other way around.
Oh, and people would have gathered round to have a look at it.
Yeah.
That's what we'll be like after Brexit, won't we, in a few years?
Jesus Christ.
Really? But you still to buy these?
I was going to mention, I mean, it's nothing really to do with the fall, but it's how do you find the energy to engage with these Brexit
people on Twitter like that, yeah.
Do you know what? A lot of it is like doodling in the margin when I've got more important things to do. Part of it is a certain, it's a bit like other people do Sudoku, you know, to keep the brain sharp.
Yeah.
And then also I've got that kind of pointless belligerence in me. And I, you know, whether it comes from that kind of Irish thing or just, you know, a lifetime of slights real or imagined, you know, I get triggered. I've done therapy, mate, you know.
Yeah. Well, you need it. Looking by some of the rabbit holes you disappear down with some of them fucking idiots.
I know, but it is quite funny. You know, it does amuse me at times. But, yeah, sometimes I do think, oh, God, why have I bothered?
It can't be good for you.
They're denser than a neutron star, aren't they?
Well, that's another thing. Bringing it back to the fall. What Mark did very well with his politics, he never got specific about stuff, so you could never pin stuff like you could on Morrissey, you know, like stupid anti-European beliefs and Brexit and all that. But Mark's sort of political view was that nebulous. He never got called out for anything, did he?
Well, he used to like to annoy everyone. So,
right.
You know, obviously, he wouldn't slag me off for being, you know, I mean, I was very far left at the time. But then he talked about going on B15, which is like a youth program on Radio 1 with Adrian Love on, and he was on with all like these students, and this is what made him right, you know. What was the one with was that the classical you know, Tonight on the
Fortress is about that Fortress, interview,
yeah, Tonight on the Vitamin B Glandular Show,
yeah,
and he was talking about that, and he said when he went on and all these kids, you know, they're all, you know, anarchy out of a bottle of air gel, and they're all goths, and they all said, well, on blah blah blah, you said that you didn't like the Americans, and he said. And he said he just wanted to spoil their party. So he's going, oh, I've never said any such thing about the Americans. In fact, I like the Americans and blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So going against them just to annoy them, and they were getting all, you know, kind of, how dare you not represent us? And he said they were just trying to get him to attack the system for them, which he always felt was a big middle-class trait.
Yeah.
There was always that feeling sometimes, you know, when you meet certain people who are quite far left but from very posh backgrounds, is like, you know, the way they would talk about you as being working class was almost as if they wanted you to man the barricades for them.
Yes.
And when you didn't, they hated you, you know. But yeah, so he was interesting like that politically, Mark, you know, and we had a lot of discussions about stuff like that. But I used to just love him going through all the people in the charts at the time, slagging them off. You know, like when, it, you know, you talk about Ian McCulloch out of, you know, Echoing the Bunnymen, and he said, well, you know, the trouble with him is he wants to be in the door. No, he thinks he's in the Doors. And what made me laugh was then when I was doing Key 103 in 88, 89, McCulloch puts out a solo single, a cover of People Are Strange.
Yeah, I know. Sold out.
Oh, You told me that 6 years ago, 5 years ago, you said that about him. So, you know, it'd be quite amusing like that.
Not the worst crime, though, really.
No, it was just quite funny. You know, it was an observance that he'd make about who was copying who. I remember talking about reggae, and he always said that his favourite reggae track at the time was Toots and the Maytals, She's My Scorcher.
Right, okay. Well, you know, he was a big reggae fan, Prince Farah.
He likes old soul as well, you know. And even when he did "Live Dream of Casino Soul," when I was chatting to him about that, he kind of, even though he was attacking, you know, the whole thing about it, he actually quite liked the fact that it was there. It was something cultural for him to write about.
Definitely, he was a bit of a Northern Soul fan, I think.
Well, he was a culture vulture.
Yeah, he had that same kind of thing with Working Class, where he was fond of it, but not afraid to slag it off, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, he it was quite funny, because he would always try and be a little bit Working Class Tory with you and all that kind of stuff. But what I used to like about him was, because obviously everyone would be quite seedy, and I'd been at Polly in London, you know, with all your kind of semi-beatnik types who are all into Susie and the Banshees. And, you know, they were the ones who got me into Joy Division and were always banging on about The Fall and stuff like that. And, the first experience you had of Manchester being a little bit cool. And what was interesting is they always had problems with the mums and dads. And whenever I met Mark, and I was like, you know, 21, 22, and he always go like this to you, go, how's your mum? And I go, yeah, she's fine, blah, 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 blah. But I think it was almost like testing the waters to see if you were all right, you know, because there was a lot of those lads who would think they were trendy, going, oh, my mum and dad, God, what can I tell you? You know, it's just telling. You know, oh, my God. They're just so different to me.
Yes, indeed. Well, then it turns out with those middle-class people, they're exactly the same as the parents, aren't they, as it turns out? That's the thing. They think they're different, but it turns out they're all exactly the bloody same with each other.
But I suppose when I use, you know, a word like middle-class in a pejorative way, what I mean was a certain attitude. You know, there was a certain attitude amongst people like that. We were a little bit spoilt and very jealous. They always seem to be extremely jealous of other people, you know, and it's kind of, whereas I just had that good old-fashioned working class resentment.
It's a much healthier thing to carry on your shoulder, isn't it?
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, at least my resentment wasn't envy.
Let me tell you about my resentment. the thing about what we were touching about Mark is that liberating thing of not giving a fuck what anybody thought of you.
Then he didn't give it after a while, you know. I remember, like, I've seen it for it.
He had a great life in that way, in the fact that he never answered to anybody.
No, I mean, the weird thing is, he sent me like Christmas cards.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, to my mum's house in Old Trafford. You know, the guy, council house. I remember coming back for Christmas 1983, and there's a card there, and it was like is it Wainwright? And it's all sheep in a field, and he put inside it, you know, because he knew I was working on Radio Derby. Obviously, it was like the population of Derby discussed the effects of brine nylon on the local economy. It was little things like this. I mean, I wish I'd kept it, but it was kind of made you feel a little bit special.
Yeah.
And even though I always had his phone number, I didn't want to use it, because I thought, why would he want to talk to me? And yet, then when I ended up working on the telly and everything, he was like, you know, as if I hadn't spoken to him for years. But I was thinking, I didn't know you wanted to be my mate. Well, do you know what I mean? He's like,
that you were saying about the Fall being popular, we were kind of, well, certainly when I was in the band, there was never any kind of thing that, look, aren't we great, you know, and people really like us. That was like, and it was never
discussed at all.
No,
never discussed. Like, oh, there was so many people at that gig. This, you know, there was so many hundred that night, and isn't this going well or anything like that?
No,
it would have seemed shallow, though, I suppose. And in some ways, that wasn't what you were about. You had that thing where everyone thought you were cool. You know, so every, you know, because I remember, like, you know, interviewing Gavin Friday, and he was talking about, you know how much, you know, he was into The Fall, and all the guys out of U2 were into The Fall. And then when I was chatting to Marky Smith about it, I said, oh, Gavin Friday said blah blah blah, you know that he'll see. He said, well, why would we give a shit whether he likes us or not?
And that was a close personal friend.
Passing on his good wishes. Sorry if somebody likes you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. In one way, it's massively liberating, but it's not something I can't imagine going through life not caring if people like me, you know, because the next thing of that is not being nice, isn't it? And because you're nice because you want people to like you, you know, so it's a difficult one to pull off, I think.
I don't know. I mean, I was very badly influenced, I think, at a young age by Mark, and I've been trying to pull back. You're saying things for effect rather than what you meant, you know, and I could never resist the urge to just say horrific things to people in, you know, in quite powerful positions.
Yeah, well, hoping that the Brexiteers all lose the job because, you know, that's what they voted for.
No, that was actually a true story. So there's a guy who does a lot of big building projects in Manchester, and then another guy that ran a big IT company, and that's what they were doing. They were getting rid of Brexiters because it was causing a downturn in their business. And so all the guys had been walking around saying it's Project Fear. They were laying them off first. So I thought, that's good, you know. It's one of those, isn't it? You voted for it. You said you didn't mind short-term pain. Suck it up and have it. But then, of course, that isn't what they really want, really. It's just a load of right-wing bluster, isn't it? You know, it's a bit like when they compare it to the spirit of the Blitz and all that. And I always think, yeah, that's fine, the Blitz spirit. Imagine if you were hunkered down with the bombs going off over your head in some shelter and the bloke next to you turned around and chuckled and went, hey, I voted for this.
Now, well, the other one I was thinking of was that you got into a bit of hot water with the anti-vaxxers. They should. I know it was a joke, wasn't it? But you've got to be careful.
Yeah, that was just poking the hornet's nest. Do you know what I mean? But it's kind of one of those where you just think, where's all this kind of idiocy coming from? I've even got a really good mate of mine actually at the moment. He keeps sending me things on YouTube. I go, he's not a doctor, he's a doctor of philosophy. He's basically someone grifting for follows on YouTube. You know what I mean? He's like Nigel Farage, who once worked in medicine.
Nigel Farage, the anti-establishment figure who went to private school, worked in the city, and then never done a day's work in his life. How he's managed to sell himself as anti-establishment, I don't know. Well, there's a few of them, though, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I was on a Question Time with Richard Tice, and, you know, he was the one who said that leaving the EU would be simple. Yeah. So I said, everything's simple if you're a bit simple.
Yeah.
So, of course, he hated that, but it was like studied with Brexiters. This was in Darlington, and the report just come out of how bad it would be for the North East Brexit. And this bloke said, well, you know, the media elite like you, Terry. And I was going, I'm the media elite from a council house in Old Trafford, one of six kids. Meanwhile, they've got Richard Tice, who inherited like hundreds of millions off his dad, yeah, and he's now got a property empire worth about half a billion. But I'm the media elite. Denser than the neutron star.
Yeah, there's a lot of it about, and it's not getting any better, is it?
No. But again, you know, with the four, what's interesting now is that I go through and I think, where have all my records gone? I've still got some of yours. I've still got Slates. Right. I've still got, This Nation Saving Grace. I've still got Part of America. And I've still got Total's Turns.
You've got all the other ones. More than me and Paul put together, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, yeah. I don't know why I flogged them all. I mean, I think a lot of them went to King B, and then I gave some away. But what another thing I'm going to do, I never got Mark to autograph any of them. Can you imagine that? Even though I could go out drinking with him, I'd be terrified to think, could you just sign this? You know, it's for my little sister.
But, I mean, is that why I think there was a whole thing where they weren't... I mean, I know there's always been collectors and that, but that... The way people hold records in esteem now, like it's, you know, is that, was that ever the same? Is that not why they're worth money now? Because no one, because no one took care of them, did they? The same.
Well, I think in my day, although I was massively into music, I was interested in hearing it. So whether I had it on CD, on cassette, I wasn't bothered as long as I had it to listen to. Yeah. So I wasn't kind of into, you know, like obviously the Northern Soul guys were different. Yeah. You know, they were the ones who collected stuff. And I believe, you know, the blokes who did the same with Old Blues. But that was it. So I was always interested in just having the record rather than, I mean, having the song to be able to listen to. I mean, you know, for me, I mean, I remember, you know, going through record shops like Paper Chase and Robinson's and all that in Manchester back in the day, spending whole days in there. I didn't even have it. I just about had enough to get me bus fare home, but just for the kind of joy of going through them all and looking at, you know, these bands who only in the last 4 years have I even bothered to find out what they sounded like, you know, like Molly Hatchet and, you know, all these great, great covers, you know, Atomic Rooster, Quicksilver Messenger Service. And you go, I wonder what they sound like. That looks really good, that cover. You know what I mean? And, you know, with all the Roger Dean posters and all that kind of stuff. So it was just different. You know, that's why we found out about records by a mate lending you an album. Yeah. Or talk to a mate and you go, oh, Elton John is rubbish. Go, no, we are. And then the next day he brings in a copy of, like, you know, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road or Caribou, you know, and then you've got to bring it home and listen to it so that you can tell him what you think the next day.
Yeah.
You know, weird.
I know it's all a bit jumpers for goalposts, isn't it? But I think you valued music more when it was harder to get hold of, I think. Do you not think?
Well, yeah, you did. I mean that's the weird thing that I say to my kids. I said, the thing is for you, I said, you can access just about any song you want now. You know, and especially on YouTube. That's the place. Spotify is still huge gaps on. I said, in our day, we won't have even heard the record. We'd just heard about a record. And you'd have to find it. Or find someone who knew it. I mean, that's why I had a Northern Soul slot on my Radio Derby show. Every week I've got this guy coming in, bringing in stuff that I could never afford or even hear.
Right.
Or I'd heard about. And then you'd ask him about a certain song and he'd go, that's rubbish, that. And I said, well, I've heard it's really good. He said, those are people who don't know about the scene. on the Northern scene, there were the ones who were into the proper soul content, you know, like your Richard Servings, you know, people like Guy Hennigan later on down the line, who was strictly all 60s, you know, people who understood what was big in the clubs. And then you get the other ones, it was just almost like semi-novelty records or anything that you could dance to or anything that might pass over. So, yeah, it was interesting like that. This is going to be really boring to people out there, isn't it?
No, not at all.
Keeping out about Northern Soul. But, I mean, yeah, just all that. You know, that's why I love that radio show I did in Derby, because I could find out about jazz funk, could find out about Northern Soul. I was quite good with reggae anyway, you know, because I grew up in an area, you know, where, you know, our street was basically, you're right, either Irish descent or Jamaican, you know. So it was like, you know, we all had guilt, but we love reggae.
Yeah.
And that was it, you know, because you heard it coming through the walls from the age of four. Yeah. And so, you know, you just learned even more about it, you know. And then I ended up managing a reggae band in the mid-80s, funny enough. Got them signed to Chrysalis, Junior C Reaction, 12-piece band, ex-Pressure Shocks. Now, they were a band back in the day.
Don't remember that.
It was easy managing a 12-piece band.
Well, I mean, it wasn't. It would have been even harder if they'd allowed me to manage them properly, especially since the core of the main three were all in their early 30s, and the rest of them were all young lads, four-piece horn section, but they were absolutely superb.
Right.
I mean, amazing, amazing band.
They can't have made much with 12 of them.
No.
Well, no, but the thing is, they got signed to Chrysalis. They released two singles. When they did their own, you know, their own label one, Cry Jehovah, Love and Emotion, Peel played Cry Jehovah, Janice Long played Love and Emotion. And a little place like Derby, that was big. You know, it's similar to the Commitments in a way. When you watch that, you know, the ripples they leave there. Mm-hmm. Although they never put a record out, you know, but it's like, it was like that, especially for the black area in Derby, Normanton. Yeah. There was never a band from Manchester, a reggae band, who got signed to a major, except for Harlem Spirit, that one single, Demi Sus in the Moss.
Blimey. Speaking about, talking, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing that. Christ almighty, that was everywhere, that song.
Brilliant, brilliant song.
Yeah, great, really good. Yeah. But I think it was like the one Manchester reggae single, wasn't it? So everywhere you went, they played it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Exodus, English Black Boys was out, but it wasn't quite. It was a bit too slow, and you know, obviously with the lyrics of Demo Sus in the Moss about the Sus Lords, mm-hmm. and then like only just over a year after it came out, you had like the riots, didn't you, in Moss Side, and one of the causes of it was the Sus Lords.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Can't say they weren't warned.
No, indeed.
Great, great record though, Demo Sus in the Moss.
Yeah. So. We're just about to wrap up, so I was just going to ask you, when was the last time you saw Mark then, before? When would that have been?
I don't know. I mean, it might have been hanging around with Ed Blaney.
Oh, yeah.
Just recently. The last time I interviewed him was just when he'd done that England's Dreaming, you know, with Shuffle Bottom. So we were in the Atlas Bar for about, God, you know, 3 hours.
Right.
Like half an hour was the interview, and the rest of it was just chatting and drinking. And then, of course, he was big mates with my mate Johnny J.
Right.
You'd say you hadn't heard of, but he produced the Dose single that he did. And him and Mark got on really well because.
Well, you didn't know him, Steve, would you?
Yes, I know him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I got edited out, but I did play on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mark thought Johnny was very professional, and Johnny thought Mark was very professional. You know what I mean? Both had that kind of cheap mill Salford thing going on of like. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Right.
And that was it.
Right. Well, I think we've come to the end of our hour's slot. It's been great to talk to you, Terry. Sorry we couldn't get any work, you know, chat out of you, but you know, we'll try and edit that together for a cozy 10 minutes, you know.
I feel like I've not talked about Mark enough because I've spent so much time with him.
No, at all. No, you talk about what you like, mate. It's only, you know. It might be a fall podcast, but it doesn't mean that's all we talk about. It was great to speak to you.
All right, brilliant. Hey, fantastic speech.
So, well, next time we'll have to get out for a pint. So we've said this to everybody who's come on. It's going to be some night out this when we go out for this pint, but we're going to have to hire somewhere, I think.
Yes, definitely. Or I'll get you on my next radio show. In fact, I need to interview anyway because I'm doing a Manchester music book covering black people as well.
Good. What time somebody did.
And I'm also doing one about being Irish descent. So I can double bubble you both, can't I?
Yeah, you're on. All right, mate. Yeah. All right.
Some good intelligent quotes going on.
Well, we'll do our best. All right, good to speak to you, mate. Take care.
Yeah,
all right. I'll speak to you soon. Thanks a lot. God bless.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Monday, so watch for the next episode in 2 weeks. Follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find a link to all our previous episodes on Spotify, iTunes and YouTube. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes and tell your friends about us. You can also check out our books about the fall, The Big Midweek and Have a Bleeding Guess, available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Hope to see you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Shout out.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.